Hello. In the solitary confinement where I exist, and probably for you in whatever the conditions are in which you exist, there's all sorts of distortions of time. It feels a little surprising to me that spring is happening at the same rate that it would be happening if we were all paying better and closer range attention to it. But the remorselessness of the calendar means that our endless course that does not meet will soon come to an end, and I feel more sense of obligation in my isolation booth to deliver the goods than I would if we were able to see one another and the goods could exist in some mutual fashion. At the outset, I said, we're trying to understand how to be more creative in law school and to be more creative about lawyering for ourselves as a role in life in the society. Being creative in law school is either easier or harder when there is no law school. This is a fundamental distortion of the ordinary proportions between presence and absence. I wonder whether you will be more creative in law school when there isn't any law school, as I wonder whether the absence of grades will have a positive or negative effect on the willingness to take chances. I know that it has seemed, when we have talked about it on the pad or elsewhere, that chance-taking will go up when there's no downside, but I'm not so sure, actually, because I do not think that the story of incentives that we usually tell ourselves, at least while we're in law school, has much to do with reality, for all the reasons Thorsten Veblen might suggest. But in any event, what will be creativity in law school will have to change now as law school recreates itself. We can't say for sure whether we will be still in classes that do not meet, or rather in classes that meet extremely strangely when the fall semester comes. My bet is that it is not possible for us to resume anything that seems like regular face-to-face education, but we'll find out. Whatever law school is, however, it will have changed. It isn't merely the collapse of the usual hiring system, although that's, God knows, interesting and potentially very good news. It isn't that the pricing phenomena are going to have to adjust themselves to the quality of the product being delivered sooner or later. It isn't just that lots of people will decide to take a leave, those who were coming, those who might have come, those who were here but might not return. It's that the very activity of being on our own, my colleagues and I, even the administration, whatever that is, the act of being on our own is clarifying to us, as it is to so many other people. We are learning in our solitude what matters and what doesn't. For people like yourselves, whose decision it is to change your lives, and really, of course, coming to law school is a decision to change your life, sometimes we soft-pedal that a little bit by talking about how we're not really sure what we intend to do with the degree, or maybe we don't mean at all to practice law, or some such thing. But really, we are, after all, proposing to change our lives by coming to law school. It changed mine. I know that it is easier for me to remember what it was like when I was a child who didn't yet know how to read than it is for me to remember what it was to be an undergraduate who read but hadn't been to law school yet. So in the determination to change our lives, the fact that the lives around us are unstable, that nothing looks as it usually looks, is, as we have tried to talk about in one or another way over the past couple of weeks, very deracinating, possibly amounting to panic striking. But for the teachers, For those for whom law school is not, as it is for you, an experience unrolling over a relatively short period of time at a staggeringly high amount of money, but rather a way of life, a living, a form of self-definition, a series of identity and personality states under development. For us, law school is changing in an even more complicated way because it's supposed to be staying the same. I'm sure that others of my colleagues among the teachers in our early 60s who have begun to accommodate ourselves to the idea that this is it, that our lives are what they are, and that we don't have to be associate justices of the United States Supreme Court in order to have completed our allotted time on earth successfully. I'm sure that for a number of us in our late life, it's probably the case that we're thinking, you know, I really expected to be able to finish my career pretty much without having to change a lot. And now, by golly, I sure am going to have to do. And by golly, we are going to have to do. So teaching how to be creative in law school would be easier if law school weren't moving. But law school is moving, as the rest of the world is moving. Persistence of vision is an illusion that our brains create. On the other hand, the perception of creativity in law school may be a little more stable than the actual creating in law school itself. We're learning to be lawyers, that is, people who make things happen in society using words. And what I set out to do these weeks ago is to suggest where to get the words from, perhaps in a different way than law school ordinarily suggests where to get the words from, because law school's usual way of suggesting where to get the words from is to assign a case and ask a question, and then you stumble to come up with some words about the case, and that's where the words of being a lawyer come from. And I don't want to deprecate that entirely. That's a very important form of legal training, and I'm glad that law school does it. And by now, after almost a year of adjusting yourselves to it, you're glad law school will continue to do that, because it's really easy for you to deal with the demands that that places upon you. You read the case and you answer the questions. In fact, of course, however, even for Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. at the beginning of this expedition of ours, to explain it on the basis of the words in the cases isn't quite right. And it is everything other than what it means just to answer the questions posed from the bench in the cases, including your own cases, that law school exists. But always it exists in the form of words. Lawyers make things happen in society using words. So the beginning of the perception of creativity in law school is the unexpected growth-inducing use of words. At the lowest level, therefore, if law school is reduced to its essence, how you perform in relation to the questions asked, whether in the classroom or on the examination, creativity in law school will come down to creative use of words in law school. Unexpected words. Words whose cadence and whose tonality is different. Words whose source is elsewhere in society than where they might be expected to come from. Words, in other words, doing the work of bringing the new. There is always, by hypothesis and sometimes by stated precept, a preference for the old words, the words actually in the cases, the words said by the teacher, the words, in other words, sanctified by their successful passage through the system, like grass through a goose. That's the apparent situation. It's always good to know what the court has said before. It's always good to have been listening and taking notes. It's good to remember what was said. I am all for successful retention and reproduction as part of the process upon which creativity works. There is ultimately some reason to believe that if you want to create a role in Shakespeare, you should begin by memorizing the lines. But that's where we begin. Part of the difficulty, therefore, with the way law school discusses creative performance in law school is that it has a blitheringly silly tendency to reduce itself to the model answer, which is why there shouldn't be any model answer and probably not any exam questions to give a model answer to. But even when we are stuck with the questions, we do not need to stick ourselves with the model answer. That is to say, recapitulation isn't creativity. Everybody knows it. You can make a piano that will play the music off the roll, but whoever cut the roll, they knew more about the action than the piano knows about itself. Therefore, to be really simple about it, creativity in law school consists of using words the teacher didn't know were going to be used. And in the examination, this is particularly true. Obviously, merely varying the vocabulary is not enough. It's that the words are used to say things in a different way. Whether that arises from fetching one's words from history or literature or scholarship in sociology or from what one hears people whistling in the street may not in the first instance matter quite as much as one's willingness to vary the script. I have talked in different ways at different times and tried to show you different lawyers at different times varying the script. And of course, there's no instruction set for varying the script. That's the whole point. To say that I go for a walk before I take examinations is to say there has to be some room for varying the script. If one becomes a little exam-taking robot and one walks into the exam perfectly prepared to sit in oiled quiet and to reproduce into the blue books that which was reproduced off the notes of the teacher into your ear, it will, in fact, obliterate creativity, right? I mean, if one chooses to make oneself uncreative, one will succeed. It's the ability to associate, not exactly freely and not exactly under ultimate constraint, which makes jazz. And jazz, I will join with my late colleague, Kellis Barker, to say, is how some people make law, particularly people who are left without power. But power emerges from, well, I don't want to be too literal about this, I suppose, but I admit that after all these decades, I really do think it comes down. Power consists of the ability to swing. That doesn't necessarily suggest either that the music will be good or that the power will be legitimate, but unless it can bend the bar line, what can it move? Right? So here what I mean to suggest, after all, is that creativity in law school is bringing to it something that the teacher didn't know that was there and putting words to it. And whether that means quoting Bleak House on an English legal history exam or Finnegan's Wake to the United States Supreme Court, I always found it useful to have some words of other people's at my disposal, but not necessarily the words of the people who were part of the circle receiving the news. You can see, whatever the degree of authenticity or mannerism there may be in it, you can see the way in which, for Larry Joseph, there is a pulse of Whitman striking always in Lower Manhattan beneath the language of his lawyers. And whether I want the Whitman or not, I must take it because it's there. When you hand an examination paper or a seminar paper or a brief draft or an anything to a teacher, and it contains some fire you brought to the subject from afar. Of course, it is possible for the bastard to mark you down, but it's really difficult. And I, at the present moment, as you confront the tedium of your limited spaces and limited opportunities, you recognize perfectly well that whoever that was on the other side of the Zoom box has the same difficulty. It is always hard to grade dozens of similar exams. The intellectual and emotional disservice done by assigning something which produces dozens and dozens of similar exemplars back is part of the reason that in my youth I decided to do away with the examination. It was merely a form of intellectual and cultural self-defense at some level. But if you put yourself in the position of those teachers who have not yet managed to find out that they're not compelled to give an exam and read these endlessly similar answers as though this was virtue or education, if you put yourself in the position of people who have a stack of the same thing to read, you can understand very well why it is a very good idea not to give them the same thing. That you have a sufficient mastery of both subject and self to provide a view of something which contains the view the teacher wishes to be sure you have, but transcends it, is to earn positive evaluation on the gold standard, is it not? Yes, if you decide to create in such a way that it is possible to deny that you know the subject, then you take a chance, perhaps unnecessarily, on being told just the facts, ma'am, and sent about your business by some Sergeant Friday of a law professor. But you won't do that. I wish that we had had more time together in which to knock the naivete off your paragraphs. I wish that we had learned more fully how to use the editorial capacities of wikis to sharpen and reduce our language, to use fewer words that hit harder, and to make those words sing as well as, well, sting where they land. But we didn't. We had only the usual, we had only the usual minus the unusual, we had only now. And still, you're more than capable of demonstrating two things at once. A, that you know the material, and B, that you are bigger than the material. And once you have demonstrated those two things, then you sit, I don't care whether it's at the top of the class, out on a limb of your own. You are you in law school, rather than somebody in law school who used to be you, or who might be you, or who someday would be you, if only. Because no matter what there is, you sing it your way. And once you have a voice, and you can use the voice, and the voice knows the law, well, then you are a lawyer, sir and madam. And that your teachers will acknowledge when they meet it, as they must, or at least they should. Still, we haven't decided, but for the fact that the words should have some difference on them, where they come from. And I don't mean that they always come from Dickens or from Joyce, for heaven's sake. This was the point of saying, not merely about creativity in law school, but creativity in lawyering, that it emerges from, permit me to use an overused word, diversity. Diversity of approach, diversity of understanding, diversity of linguistic and cultural forms, diversity, most importantly, in ways of seeing, is, well, I can't say the center of creativity, because I've tried to suggest in various different ways, musical and literary and by sheer negligence on my own part, I've tried to suggest that it's not really ever possible to give the list of ways of seeing, or to use it in a list-like fashion. Rather, ways of seeing superimpose themselves on the world. One can think like an epidemiologist without being one. Heaven knows, we are all around us now subsumed in the words on Medium and otherwise of all the people who think they're epidemiologists for the day. Which would be fine if they were also theologians and philosophers and policy scientists and economists too. That is to say, if what they were trying to do was to think like a lot of different people think, and to make benefit not out of being as expert as the expert, or being more intellectually unconstrained than those actually responsible for the conduct of professional decision making, but simply to have a bunch of different ways of coming at a thing, to deepen one's perspective, to make more parallax, to give more ways of approaching the matter. From a lawyer's point of view, this can be thought of as a willingness to reconfigure doctrine. Stroud Francis Charles, that is Toby Milsom, who taught me English legal history as he taught an entire generation English legal history. Toby says that the life of the common law has been in the abuse of its fundamental conceptions. If contract gives the wrong answer, try tort, and experience will show that from tort it is possible to manufacture all the phenomena of contract. If contract and tort give the wrong answer, try trust, and so the legal world goes round. Toby meant two things when he said that. The first, that after all, lawyers trying to push the system around on behalf of their clients are the source of creativity. Those who always had the winning side of easy cases would never have to create anything. They would be the greatest of legal traditionalists. But Toby's other point is that when the business of deciding cases is done a case at a time, and in the form in which the words of the judge will be more important than the words of the textbook, when the common law is the form of thinking that we're thinking, then it is our ability to maneuver the conceptions, to turn them 180 degrees, to formulate one question in terms of the language of another, which provides the opportunity upon which the necessity of the client breeds the lawyer's invention. But I wanted in this course to suggest that in approaching law school, this is true at a higher level of abstraction, in the way we think not only about the law, but about the society within which the law is merely one of many things embedded, like the spikes on a coronavirus. The law is an aspect of a series of other subjects to which it is narrowly connected, including how a society learns what it knows, and how a society expresses the principles it believes itself to have, and how a society uses process both to create the appearance of fairness, and so the people who usually win can go on winning, and how the way in which the society performs those tasks is related to its drama, to its literature, to its learned arts, and as Thorsten Veblen would put it, to its ways of demonstrating pecuniary strength by waste. In other words, the law is culturally generated in a form which corresponds to a series of material and social needs, and which reflects both contestation over the social outcomes, who wins, who gets the money, who gets to push whom around, who is enjoined, and who is confined for contempt, but also to determine how the resulting outcomes will be narrated and understood, whether they are the free market, the freedom of contract, the working man's constitutional liberty to work as many hours as he can for as little as he can get paid, and so on and so forth. And in that process, we, whose job it is not merely to stand back and talk about it in a classroom, but to go out and get something done, to make something happen in society using words, are always trying to affect that process marginally. That may be by winning one acquittal, or by consummating one deal, or by passing one word string in a piece of legislation with so many word strings in it that nobody knows everything about what is really going on, but the legislature is dutifully said to have intended whatever it was that was, however accidentally, enacted. Whatever it is that we are trying to do, whatever effect we're trying to have upon a social process, the more ways in which we can see that process from the larger number of angles, with the greater sympathy for the various positions of the people caught up in it and acting under whatever the impulses of the system are as it relates to them, the more that we can know, not necessarily describe mathematically or write down algebraically, but the more that we can know, the more that we can feel in an integrated way, as though we were Beethoven hearing a symphony or a string of profound quartets in his head, the more we can, like Darwin, have in the garden that we share it with the sister who keeps house for us, the idea of what the history of life might be, the more that we can have, as Evelyn Keller says in her extraordinary biography of Barbara McClintock, a feeling for the organism, the more that we can have a sense of what it means for society to be alive in whichever form of life it is, its criminal courts, its tax system, its public health regulations, whatever it is that we are trying to understand, the more deeply and in the round we can understand it, the more creatively we can respond to it, both on behalf of clients and on behalf of ourselves as constructors of our work lives. That we are constructors of our work lives, as that we are the people who create our examination responses, that we are not made as though stamped out by a cookie cutter or cast out of wonky metal in a somewhat derived cast, which is the 14th copy being used for the 14,000th. We're not an industrial product. Law school's not a factory. There is always a tendency to behave as though one were material being machined. The law school, the administration, the faculty, the employers are busy pressing you into some shape. But that's, of course, again, what creativity is designed to make go away. The idea of being acted upon is all very well, but once one has for oneself created something, a plan, an intention, a daydream, a thought, a hope, set of feelings about how life should be lived, even the most tiny of the assertions of independent, growing, changing selfhood is enough to take the factory and reduce it once again to mere environment. Once we have a conception of what it means to become a lawyer, once that process is not something being done to us, but done by us through others, that we will create law by being thus and such a kind of lawyer is no more unreasonable than to say that we will create work by being such and such a kind of worker, or family by being such and such a kind of parent and spouse, or a community by being such and such a kind of citizen. All of these are creative tasks, of course, and all of them we tend to perform automatically as though mere reproductions of some ideal, our parents, our teachers, our leaders, our gods. But in truth, every single day being created by the action of character upon the circumstances, even as you know now, that in the similarity of one day to another after epidemic lockdown, even though the days are made of the same parts, it takes only a new orientation gathered overnight, a new conception raised in the morning, a new way of thinking about what it means to be in this space for yet another day, to change it. Confinement is in that sense both very heavy and very light. And to be confined alone, as I am, is lighter still, as all the other efforts at creating a bad day or oversleeping or underperforming around the other inhabitants of the ville don't touch me. They're going on somewhere else. And so whatever I bring to each day is what the day consists of. But whatever you bring to the life of the lawyer is what the lawyer's life consists of. And the dullness, the dimness, the unawareness of that of which Martha Thoreau is so conscious in others and perhaps has also suffered time to time from it herself, despite all her efforts to the contrary. This is the background against which our creativity works, like the theme being varied or the classic piece of the American Songbook being put through the lost and found of Bill Evans and Miles Davis. The nature of the creativity that is involved in saying about a phenomenon put on a law school exam, whether in some gory hypothetical or some policy-oriented, open-ended question, the task of bringing to it something larger than what is in it, something of one's own, which rides alongside and corresponds with that which is asserted legal reality, whether it is the background of the hypo or the nature of the policy dispute about which the question is aimed, or just the fact that most law school examinations have a very small segment of society in mind when they are asked, but affect much larger, deeper, and more interesting collections of human beings than the questioner immediately thinks about, which offers an opportunity. At any rate, whatever it is that one brings to it that isn't there in the mind of the person who framed it, that's the act which creates your lawyering on that examination, in that paper, in that room, at that moment, and also the act which begins the process of identifying you to yourself as someone who has an art, who has acquired it with effort and practiced it in some degree of, pardon the expression, suffering, and who has earned the right to use that art the way she wants. That, after all, is where the creativity of career comes from the wanting to do it your way. I appreciate that there is both wisdom and apparent compulsion in the point that how can you do it your way if you're just a newbie and you don't know how to do it yet? And that's right. That is to say, the process of learning is about learning to do it your way in a way that will work and not in a way that won't. But to say beyond the whether it works or not for the client you have chosen to have, to say that beyond that there is some right way or wrong way to do it, well, yes, if it would otherwise constitute perjury or obstruction of justice, you should not do it that way. Yes, if it involves telling a lot of lies, you should not do it that way, etc. But where what we mean is, I can bring something to this score that wasn't there. I can make a thing jump off the page and dance around in this blue book that nobody expected would be there until I set about doing it. To say that that will lead one to think, you know, I wish to earn my living. I wish it to be a good living. I wish to bring home as much bacon as the case will demand, but, on the other hand, I wish to do it in the way which is my way and not some other way. That's as valid for a lawyer as for the practitioner of any other art, and just as, ultimately, I would say, necessary as if one were planning a career in music or cartooning. It must be done my way. I feel that about my practice. I don't want anybody else's practice. Mine may need things it hasn't got, or have limitations I wish it didn't have, or may be inevitably affected by the sinfulness of my nature and the sloth and pride and whatever else it is that I bring to it. But it is mine. I spent decades making it. I spent decades thinking about the issues that concerned me, and I spent decades building relationships in various places around the world, from technical universities to technical corporations to government officials to young lawyers that would make it possible for me to do what I wanted to do. And of course, in the end, the way I did it was as much mine as I could make it, whether I had an exacting client or a client who wanted to let me run, whether I was building the organization on whose behalf I was bringing the claims or taking the existing set of relationships and madnesses for granted, whether I was doing something that I deeply wanted to do, or whether I was doing a chore that actually I felt conflicted about. Still, at the end of the day, what made me go home happy was to know that I had done a good job that was mine. And by mine, I often meant nobody told me what to do, and probably nobody else would have done it this way, but this is the way I thought it up, and it worked, and therefore, I have made it. Now, of course, I have been an employee of somebody or other much of that time. Sometimes myself, sometimes a university which, having granted me tenure, had very little ability to tell me what to do, but sometimes, not necessarily as the consequence of a large fee, sometimes pro bono publico, I put myself under the employment of a client who had strong opinions which weren't mine, and needs I didn't necessarily agreed with, and who sent me out into the world to behave in ways I might not necessarily have liked to behave myself, but it was in the interest of the client, and thus I did it, whatever asshole it made me look. And I'm not suggesting for an instant that the way that this art is practiced is in the refusing to listen to anybody about anything, even the people who employ you. Architects may become very tyrannical when great. They may think they actually design and build for people who merely commission and pay for but don't understand, and good on them. But in the art I practice, the ultimate subordination of the will of the lawyer to the will of the client, like the ultimate requirements of meter and of rhyme, I'm not absolutely free to do away with. And indeed, the poet is not really morally questionable if she refuses meter at any given moment, and like the horse won't jump the gate, but the lawyer who abandons the primacy of the client has abandoned the license too. So when I say that to be creative in law school is to begin being creative about career, I mean that once you have started making the paintings or the music or the theater for yourself, even a little bit, it's very hard to take the position that you're just a jukebox or a paint-by-numbers printer or a dramatics drone. To begin by having both a sense of knowing your law and also having something else to say is already subversive of the idea that you are on a canned meat conveyor belt and that at the other end you will be stamped and welded down and priced perfectly and sold into a very luxurious market in which when they slurp you out of the can, you're already earning $190,000 a year. Slurped out of the can. Nobody can deny, as I have not tried to deny, that there will be a flight to safety after this plague begins to ease. The law school wants you to fly to safety. The law school itself needs to fly to safety. The airlines need you to fly to safety. Everybody would like to go back to normal, in which, of course, it was expected that you didn't have to create anything very much. You just had to get the Columbia degree and monetize it. And the people who lend on Columbia degrees were perfectly happy for you to become a commodity lendee of the monetization of the degree and work in the pawn shop in the back, and everything will be just, but it won't. I don't mean that the revelation of society's injustices and inequities, as radical as they are, is going to cause society to change. It won't cause society to change. It may allow society to change, but there will still be people using words to change it, and they might be you. At any rate, if they're not you, it will be harder to ignore the fact that some people will be trying to change society fairly deeply when this is over, as there will, of course, be a very well-funded team trying to make everything go back to the way it used to be. Liberate Michigan. But in fact, it is not possible to liberate American society from its post-coronavirus future. It just isn't. Whatever is going to happen in there has not happened yet, and your force will add to wherever you decide to put it just exactly as much as you decide to make it count. And so the returns to creativity will be not insubstantial in these next decades. Finding new ways to do things in response to the new ways that society has developed will be the most interesting, maybe lucrative, certainly personally reinforcing of the ways that one can meet the new. And you will, as I have said before, be the oldest young lawyers in that process. The people who began it first, who got there earliest, you can, if you put the next 2 years' mind to it, have come to some conclusions about how things will be different and how you might make them better in whatever way you consider better or more meaningful, while also making some dough with which to keep your head above water, cover your nut, and have a little left over to grow upon. Not unreasonable. That is to say, there will be lots and lots of people who will perforce be required to try imagine new ways of doing things after the virus. Their old ways have come to grief. Through no fault of their own, they lost their jobs, they lost their fortunes, they lost their ways of being. They have to find something new. American society, with its inbuilt preference for the possibility of reinvention, will help them to it. Once people can move around again, by God, they will. But in all of that, there will be a desire on the part of those with privilege to make use of it, to get themselves a deal that recognizes that the deal they used to have can be turned into something better for themselves. I don't just mean that Mr. Bezos has figured out a way to become $24 billion richer from the immiseration of all the retailers in society. That goes without saying. That's the machine on normal. But there will be lots of people finding new ways, new industries, new kinds of business, new opportunities of various sorts, and they will run into various problems and they will need various lawyers. Once upon a time, there was a Chief Justice of the United States named John Marshall, and as you are aware, he changed an awful lot because things were new, and if he could control the microphone, he could get a lot of things said. But John Marshall wasn't, as the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court under Thomas Jefferson and after, John Marshall wasn't merely inventing because the times... John Marshall was a man of invention himself, and brought to the task of being Chief Justice, not the first, not the second, but the third, a form of liability to invention, a propensity to invent. When John Marshall got out of the army at the peace in 1783, his practice was in a new legal specialty, the conduct of pension claims by Revolutionary War soldiers. The Continental Congress, having provided a pension system for the demobilized Continental Army, men who had served needed people to help them file the paperwork, and John Marshall began a practice in Revolutionary War pensions out of in the beginning of the soldiers who had served under him as an officer in the army and who looked to him for guidance as they had been doing for years already. And so his practice was built on a new area of specialty in a client base of his own raising, and that, not the effort to displace some of the great Virginia practitioners of the pre-war period, was where his career was built. As opposed, let us say, to those great New York lawyers, Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, who did indeed inherit practices in New York City under British occupation. Most of the leading lawyers in the city were Tories who left when the British Army evacuated New York City, and the practices that they had held, practices in the Hudson River Valley landlords and the practices of the city's merchants, were open for young people to move into. This I spent, I admit, a youth writing a doctoral dissertation about. But Marshall is the better image for you of what it means to be the lawyer in a new phase like the new phase we are entering than that of the great Hamilton and Burr. Not only because whether you come to rest in Trinity Churchyard one year or another, it's still not necessarily where you wish to come to rest, but more importantly because the idea of new practices built on new subjects out of new client bases in a new world with different legal problems in it is correctly what we would now call the historical model of the aftermath of the plague. If I were you, I would become an expert on the CARES Act. Not, I think, because in fact you're going to practice the CARES Act when you get out of law school, but because the successors of the CARES Act will be very important in the world to come. All the understandings about how to do things right now. Is there a business in your social, I don't mean physical, neighborhood which needs to file Paycheck Protection Act claims with the United States government? Do you know somebody in state unemployment insurance law who can navigate the system which is causing millions of people to be unable to get their unemployment claims in? And can you work with such a person to bring some people their unemployment checks? If you were now busily asking yourself, how could you put $10,000 worth of business together over the next 3 months in order to meet the nut, could you do it? There will undoubtedly be problems in your neighborhood you will see flying by. I don't mean physically, of course, but in the Zoom cocktail hours and the family conversations, there will be things that need doing, and a person who knew how to do them and who charged reasonably for the task of getting them done would soon have a growing practice. Of course, in order to have clients and conduct legal representation, you need licenses, but there are many things that you can do without licenses. Service businesses in general, we are told, are being pummeled, and that's true. It's hard to run a dry cleaner's now. But it's easier to run a lawyering practice than a dry cleaner's by a long chalk. Your problems, unlike your garments, don't have to be handed to you across the counter, and they can be worked on in multiple places through multiple hands. I'm not actually suggesting you should build a law practice this summer. It would be good after the first summer in law, after the first year of law school, to spend the summer doing something completely different. And in our world, completely different is the one thing you can count upon. But I do mean that it is good to cultivate the eye. If I needed to find some problems people had that I could solve and that they would pay me for solving, are the number of such problems going up around me or going down? Well, almost without regard to where you are, I think you could come rapidly to the conclusion that they are growing up, and you would be right. There isn't any shortage of people with problems needing help. There isn't any shortage of lawyers either when you come to that, but they're ill-distributed, always. Too many of them working in the pawn shops on the problems of the people the pawnbrokers already deal with, who may very well have lots of problems too just about now, but the problems that they have aren't necessarily conducive to the building of a good practice by youngsters starting out. Of course, the usual problem arises. How would I actually operate such a thing? Right now, you barely have to worry about that at all. If you could do some people some useful favors and take a few checks, you could cash the checks and put them in the bank account and declare the income as professional services on your tax return, and you'd be just fine. But in the longer run, of course, you do need to know how to run the law practice, a small one, just the one that you would need to run and capable of growing because built upon expandable stock. And there should be a course for that. And maybe if law school continues in the fall in some way that I can imagine being part of, I'll teach one. But at the moment, the real question is, how would you use a lawyer's theory of social action to have a practice? And as to that, of course, I'm old now, and I'm accustomed to thinking about it, and so even though I don't know much about the society around me, I can still think of ways to get paid. A lawyer's theory of social action takes account of the multiplicity of personality, and therefore a lawyer's theory of social action is aware of the fact that inside every dwelling place and every hunker down location in the society are people, every one of whose personality states are yelling, "This is not my life." As a result of which, a lot of things are happening, many of them very bad. Increased domestic violence, for example, too much drinking where the alcohol supply is uncontrolled for another, and etc. But that's not all that's happening. People are beginning to get impressions about stuff they want. Some people want to make wills. It would be good to be able to help them do that. Some people actually do want to change their lives and figure out how to take advantage of whatever the mechanisms are for time relief from their obligations in order to learn a new thing or collect a little bit of money to start a tiny little business when it's over, or what, and could use some help. The environment in which we are living is clarifying other people's thinking too, as well as it's clarifying yours. Not only do they know better what they mean to do next, they really know better what they mean to leave behind. And both decluttering and restarting whatever they're going to do, lawyering can be helpful to them. But they need a bright person who can understand what they need and help them get it and isn't engaged in exploiting them, only in assisting them for a reasonable fee. Some portions of the practice you might want to invent you cannot do anything about while in coronavirus lockdown, and some of the others you can't do anything about even after the end of coronavirus lockdown because you'd have a lot to learn, but you have lists. Things I could do right away. Things I could do only after I had taken a course or two and got a license. Things I could do if I could find somebody who wanted the clients I could bring in and who already has a law practice in which I could participate. You could have pieces of paper on a pad with each of those categories of ideas. And you could read those ideas over from time to time and scratch out a couple and put another couple down. Because nothing matters until 2 years from now. Because there's lots of time and lots of people to meet. But if you have a radar with some objects on it, things you're steering at, things you're investigating, things you're keeping watch over, ideas I have about practice I might like, if you've got that, you are wealthy. Wealthy in the thing which so many people cannot be wealthy in now, not because they aren't as smart as you are, but because they're poorer and more cornered. Wealthy in the opportunities of the future. Wealthy in ideas about what will happen afterwards. That's what creativity is as wealth, you understand. It's options. It's possibilities. It's things to think about. And you have those. More of them, in fact, than law school ever lets you show to yourself or other people, and therefore you may doubt that you have them. They seem far away. When I ask people to imagine their law practices, they imagine their feelings, their principles, their I wish to help the poor and the downtrodden. Naturally, it isn't yet your first impression to say, I imagine getting paid $100,000 a year by 12 different people to do $8,300 each of this or that kind of work. Any more than it would necessarily be your idea how many hot dogs you could sell if you opened a truck. But if you've run a hot dog truck, then you know how many you can sell, and you know basically how many people there would have to be standing around in order to buy your lunch in order for you to make enough money to go home with something. Which is better than being in the West Texas oil business right this minute, where all you can do is put it in a tank and hope somebody buys it later, and once your tank fills up, you're done. Which is, after all, pretty much the way it is to be Cravath or Sullivan and Cromwell or Gibson Dunn at the present moment. You could fill all the tank with lawyers' hours now, but if nobody will buy them, they will go stale in the tank, and what will you do then? And so you begin cutting associate salaries and hoping that the deals come back pretty soon, just as soon as CEOs can afford to risk the contamination that would be involved in signing papers. New ways are good in a new land. New ways are good in a new life. Yours will be a new life in a new land. Of course, everybody will tell you, you better hustle to the late version of the early interview program, because there are only a few jobs, and if the summers are going to get cut, then where are these jobs going to... And trust me, they are indeed very worried about that. Because they must sell you a product on an existing brand at an existing price, and they have to make you believe that that product is worth buying at that price. And the truth is, it is, except it's not the product that's worth the price. It's neither the Columbia degree nor the Columbia network in its present disrupted state. What makes it worth the price is that, bright as you are and capable as you are, if we could help you to figure out what you wanted to go to work on, you would go to town. And the price is worth it if we are helping you to achieve not merely graduation or employment, but the beginning of a career which is for you great. Then it is worth it. Then every dime was worth it. Because you will have a life in which you will affect society in ways that you consider meaningful. And you will have a substance that you consider ample, and you will not have given in to a dullness that causes you to discover only too late that, is this really all there is? I do not know whether the working people of the United States are going to be better off or worse off when we have reached some new social equilibrium after the virus. It depends a lot on who is President of the United States and who is appointed to the National Labor Relations Board and who is sitting in the United States Senate and how much we can get the common collective self-determination rights of working people to be respected in the law of the economy again later. As well as what we decide to do about healthcare policy and science policy and the overgrowth of the finance sector in New York City and the rest of the United States and so on and so on. I do not know, and you don't either. But if you know what your values are and you know how you wish to pursue them and you know how to cover the nut, the society that will grow out of this, into which you will graduate as young lawyers, will be a fine place to do your work, to practice your art, to refine your craft, to learn how to get even better results for even more people, and to be more efficient and more profitable in your practice in doing so. All of that's within your grasp. We ought to be capable of helping you. I find it difficult from the phone booth to know exactly how I am to help because my old ways of helping depended upon our old ways of being. But then in my 60s, I must find new ways to teach. As you will find new ways to practice law, not just for you, but for everybody, as I would hope that my ways of teaching will be new, not merely in the sense that I will not have done them before, but in the sense that they will suit my art by being an art that only I could have dreamed up. And of course, if free software law was a thing that I dreamed up, and largely it was, and if my ways of teaching this course that never meets were mine, and surely they were, and warts and all on both of those and everything else, when I ask myself what happens if the virus knocks me down and throws ground glass into my lungs and I have to decide whether I want to be intubated or not, the answer is no, thank you. I have done my work. My art exists. I'm ready to take a bow. And before I will be an object taking up the lives of doctors and nurses and possibly fatally infecting them myself, I will prefer to go to my long rest because I've earned it. I'm not entirely ready to say I've done everything I can with what I have. I'm not ready when the crisis is over to go to Arlington National Cemetery and stand by my boss's grave and tell him, "You got it, boss. I did what I could with what I had." I'm not quite there yet, so I would like the virus to leave me alone just a little longer in the case that I might be able to achieve that. But you don't have to worry now about what they will put on your tombstone, any more than you should actually have to worry now about how you're going to pay the loans back. Because both of those are really about a date in the future with destiny of a certain kind. How you manage to keep the book wider than the nut for long enough to accumulate what it took to pay the loans off and go on about your life, or what happened when it came to an end a little sooner than you anticipated. There isn't room left in our term for some of the games that I might play around that, some little pieces of theater or music that I might choose to put before you when I say that life is not forever, it's sometimes pretty short. Nobody needs to be reminded of that now. You can see it around you well enough. And nobody needs to be told right now that you have advantages, because indeed, I mean, not just your massive $315 refund, but in many other ways too, you see that you have leverage in a society of a kind that right now keeps people alive. Because it is those who have it not, the old, the ill, the brown, the black, the downtrodden, the merely very poor, are assigned illness in this system of the moment, and not necessarily assigned good health care either. And so it turns out that their dreams are shattered, and their families are hurt, and they themselves suffer and are taken before their time. And although we cannot eliminate that possibility from our own futures. Not you. We know the odds are in our favor all the way along. Everything is set to make it possible for us to keep moving upward, moreover. And you will. And as you do, it will be apparent to you that some revaluation of values occurred during this time of isolation and withdrawal. Some stuff that used to be important wasn't quite so important anymore. From the Thorsten Veblen point of view, we have broken all series of structures of demonstrative waste and excess, and whether it's the $6 cup of milk with the 15 cents of coffee in it on the corner in the Starbucks cup, or it's the expenses of the maintenance of a young person seeing and being seen in the great cities of the world, or some of it matters in a relative way, but already after just a couple of weeks, the really deep automatic convincing quality it used to have, yes, I have to do this, if I didn't do this, who would I be, has been countered by the growth of a new personality state. I am still here inside this apartment, house, quarantine. I am still here, yet I am different in some way that you must take account of, you, the rest of me, must take account of. And in that process, you begin to understand what the room might be. Those things pushed out of the way a little bit, those details over on the side, you can begin to see what it might be to put a lawyer in between those things. A person dedicated to doing certain kinds of work, achieving certain kinds of social results, using certain kinds of language in certain ways to make things happen, and then to take some payment for it. But even more importantly, to have a meaning of service. To be doing it for a reason which is both externally apprehensible. I am helping the incarcerated population of Mississippi assert its rights against an indifferent and overbearing state, or I am raising the standards of living of hundreds of thousands of people. But also an internally given standard of value, which arises from the sense that I'm an artist practicing my art at a high level, making something beautiful out of that which I am given to work upon, and showing the nature of my spirit, my mind, my energy, my being in the course of what I do. There are people among us in our group who have the idea that, you know, I want to be able to have a job I can leave behind. I want to go home to my family and forget about it. And that, too, is real, and there isn't any reason not to be able to achieve it. The meaning doesn't have to lie entirely within the boundaries of the work or within the boundaries of the practice. That's not the point, after all. The art's part of the life, an important part of the life, a part not to be forgotten, a part without which the great Freudian pillars of love and work won't be the same. But the meaning of the work fits inside the meaning of the life, and coronavirus helps to discover somewhat the meaning of the life. Maybe in inverse proportion to the population size with whom one is confined, but maybe not. I talk to people who are having epiphanies even as their small children are underfoot and their stay-at-home sposi are driving them mad. But it isn't just a question of the snatched reflections of the moments we spend with our loved ones. It's that the entire process of quieting the social whir, a kind of collective meditation in which the static of our reality goes down and the silences underneath come up, the relief pattern
that we are making of the normal and the everyday and the automatic and the common sense as we smooth out those inessentials and come to grips with what we are really frightened of and hope for. In that process, if you are going to be a lawyer, your lawyering is in there. You can find it. Not in some technical, doctrinal, or account books way. Not in the sense of leaping wholly like Athena from your head all at once, my practice, my client base, my financial structures, my co-workers, my partners. Not like that. Not like the discovery that your future was hidden in a box in the closet and you just had to open it. But rather in the sense that with all the ordinary future canceled and all the ordinary this is how it's done and I go here and I go there and then I get this job and then I go to that place and this positions me for, when all of that stuff's off the boards, when all the shallow sequencing of I will do this because it will improve my position for that is all baked out, destinations matter now. The things we really mean, the stuff that we would feel inadequate if we couldn't find a way back to, that thing that drives us, it doesn't define us now any more than it will define us later, but it helps to shape what we intend, and what we intend is what law school is about. I said at the beginning, and I have a week left in order to make good on the proposition that law school is an imagination test. Almost everybody fails. The most popular mode of failure is not showing up for the exam. But that popular mode of failure, that's the one the pass-fail system leaves behind. There isn't any exam you can't show up for now. Everything's on Zoom. Oh, you could forget the time zone, but it's easy to deal with. Instead, what matters now is that you do show up for the exam every single morning. Another day, just like the day before, just like the day before, and maybe like tomorrow and next week. But when you look in the mirror, you have showed up for the exam. Imagining life is what you can and must now do. Everybody's doing it. They're not doing it very well. They have no options. They have no choices. They must put on the inadequate protective gear and go out into a world which won't let them eat if they don't work. Or they are so deeply given to the narcissisms that they had before that they can't get rid of their sense of self long enough to ask what really matters anymore. But mostly, people must imagine. They fall back upon imagining when everything else is gone and there are no Netflix cue items left to avoid imagining with. And here again, how well placed you are. How good to be in your position. Oh, I know the terrible overhang of debt, and like all the other numbers, they're just numbers now. The reality is society is changing in the directions that you will help to define, in new circumstances that the older lawyers of the society will be no more well-to-do in than you are yourselves. There will be much to do and many people to do it for, and it is now for you to decide what the meaning of your practice is and how to bring it about. And I have, after all, just two more tries. One for the meaning of the practice, one for how to bring it about, and that will be that. Talk to you soon.